Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And this right here, this is my stainless steel water bottle that I bring with me into the studio every day. And I'll admit, I recently bought it because, well, of news reports that are everywhere like this.
By now, we've all heard about the BPA concerns involving plastic water bottles.
Three states are telling companies that make baby bottles and baby formula containers.
The concern is if a child ingests it, it could cause developmental and behavioral problems.
Well, BPA, or bisphenol A, is as ubiquitous as those news reports. It's a chemical commonly added to plastics to make them more pliable. And yes, it is in water bottles, baby bottles, toys, medical devices, cell phones, you name it. Problem is, scientific studies have shown that BPA could be linked to cancer, chromosomal, and hormonal disorders, especially in young children. And if you think you've done everything you can to live a BPA-free lifestyle, including drinking from only that trusty stainless steel water bottle, think again. Studies show that BPA is present in the urine of 93%. Of the U.S. population. Now, Massachusetts has proposed a limited ban on children's sippy cups and baby bottles that contain BPA. So, do you think Massachusetts should actually pass this partial ban? Or is the current alarm over BPA overblown? And in a world where more than 80,000 chemicals are registered for use in the United States, are we focusing too much on just this one? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a message on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's a professor at Harvard Medical School, a noted author, and a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His latest article in the current issue of The New Yorker is The Plastic Panic: How Worried Should We Be About Everyday Chemicals? Dr. Groopman, welcome to Radio Boston.
Pleasure to be with you.
It's really wonderful to have you. So why don't we just sort of set the scientific table here and really give a close definition as to what BPA is and what the concerns are over its potential health effects.
Well, BPA is a chemical that was identified in the early 1930s. It has a chemical structure which is somewhat related to estrogen and was originally considered as a contraceptive, but was found to be too weak in terms of changing a woman's hormonal balance and therefore wasn't pursued. It turns out it's used, as you said, widely in plastic manufacturing and also in things like dental sealants. It's used in canned foods. It's very important in reducing contamination of foods with dangerous bugs that cause botulism and so on. And there are very conflicting studies, mostly in rodents, about how much of a risk BPA really poses, both regard to cancer as well as fertility.
Hmm. And yet, you also, in your New Yorker piece, regarding some of those studies, for example, there seems to be pretty conclusive evidence that BPA does indeed leach out of those plastic liners and is present in the bodies of people. And one study that you mentioned out of the Columbia Mailman School of Public Health of 2,000 mothers found that almost 100% of them had BPA in their urine.
Absolutely. So there's no question that these chemicals are not inert in terms of leaching out of plastics. There's actually studies done in the neonatal intensive care units in Boston from the Centers for Disease Control and the Harvard School of Public Health that found that BPA, as well as phthalates, another chemical in plastics, leach out of the intravenous tubing and go into the children in the ICUs. This was recently published. So there's no question we have these chemicals in our bodies.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is, how dangerous are they, and how much precaution should we take?
So have there been any conclusive studies so far that even show a correlation between elevated levels of BPA in the blood and things like cancer, endocrine disorders, other diseases like that?
Right. So most of the studies actually look at urine because it moves pretty quickly through the bloodstream. There are these correlations, and they are, we shouldn't ignore them. There are studies, for example, in Japan that show correlations with fertility problems in women, what's called polycystic ovarian syndrome, where the ovaries develop these cysts, and they correlate with high levels of BPA in the urine. There are other studies, though, that have failed to find a very strong association. And one of the vexing things for scientists as well as policymakers is that correlation is not causation. You can find associated chemicals, but it's very difficult to prove that they actually are causing the person's problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Groopman, if it's difficult to determine that the BPAs are causing the person's problem, and yet, on the other hand, I mean, I just told everyone that I drink out of a stainless steel water bottle. You've seen people, I'm sure, all around you do the same. There's this feeling out there that, indeed, BPAs are harmful.
We don't know that yet, but I think that each individual can make a determination about how much risk you want to take in the face of uncertainty. Where, you know, we're not, none of us is comfortable with uncertainty. I would very much like there to be definitive studies to say, yes, you know, we have enough information to say BPA is really dangerous, just like we know, say, cigarettes are dangerous in the environment or asbestos is dangerous in the environment, or no, these kinds of associations that we found are really an artifact and BPA is safe. But in the meantime, we're not going to know that for quite a while, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's perfectly reasonable for you to drink out of a stainless steel, you know, water bottle. And I think it's particularly important to recognize that pregnant women and infants are potentially the most vulnerable to these environmental chemicals because they pass from the mother across the placenta to the baby, and the baby is not mature enough yet to have the enzyme systems to break down these chemicals the way adults do. So when we're talking about how much risk one can take or should take in the face of uncertainty, I think we should pay most attention to the most, you know, vulnerable populations, which are pregnant women and infants.
Listeners, you can join us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Really, what do you think about these potential chemicals in plastics that could be leaching into your food, into what you drink? Do you think they should be banned? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. We've got some calls here. Lynn is calling from Gary, Indiana. Welcome to Radio Boston, Lynn.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to comment on the question that you asked a few minutes ago about whether about the correlations and whether we're seeing the some of the endpoints you mentioned, like cancer and other things. And I just wanted to say that by the time we see those specific endpoints in human beings, it's really too late because the exposures have already occurred, the diseases are already happening, and it's much harder to turn back the clock and get those chemicals out of the environment. But if we understand that we want to take a do basic public health, which is prevention, primary prevention, then of course we want to ban those things. And if we later find out that they're not as dangerous as we thought, then they can be introduced back into society. But our real effort should be to find non-hazardous substitutions and alternatives, and we should be looking much more, focusing much more on hazard rather than on this risk model that says, you know, we're going to expose you and then we're going to figure out how much is safe or not.
Mm-hmm. Lynn, thank you so much for your call. Dr. Groopman, this is something you do touch upon in your article, and that's the challenge of deciding when risks become adequate enough for action, is it not?
Yes, but I also will echo what Lynn just said at the end of the article. You know, I call for serious investment in trying to identify substitute chemicals that can be used where, given the uncertainty of risk of BPA and the others, we can efficiently manufacture products. But in terms of the risk trade-off, I mean, it's argued by people who look at the BPA data and say that it's just not convincing. And even some of the early advocates who thought BPA was quite dangerous have changed their views with more research. Others still think it's potentially dangerous. But that BPA and chemicals like this are very important in, say, preventing food spoilage,
mm-hmm.
with all the risks that that brings to us. So I think that the best strategy is the one that Lynn just articulated, which is to invest in finding substitutes. But in the meantime, we do have to make these difficult choices.
Dr. Grubman, you mentioned industry and various studies that have come both out of independent scientific organizations and those who sometimes challenge them. But we spoke a little earlier today with Julie Goodman. She's a toxicologist at Gradient, an environmental consulting firm in Cambridge. And here's what she had to say about the safety of BPA.
There have been hundreds of studies on the health effects of BPA, and while some effects have been noted in some studies, if these effects were truly caused by BPA, then the same effects should have been found consistently among studies, and this isn't the case. Moreover, many large, well-conducted, multi-generational studies with exposures to mice and rats in the womb have shown no adverse effects from low doses of this BPA. So one should be wary of the argument that people should avoid BPA to be safe, because this can lead to risks from other chemicals that aren't as well tested, as there is no evidence that alternatives to BPA are safer.
Now, that's Julie Goodman. She's a toxicologist at Gradient, an environmental consulting firm in Cambridge. And Dr. Grubman, let me ask you about what she said. Like, what would be the alternatives in a world where we already have 80,000 registered chemicals in use in the United States? And I believe you wrote that some 7% of them actually go through comprehensive toxicology of some kind. How do we know what options are better?
Well, she's completely correct in that the entire system now, it needs to be revised. And there's legislation that's been introduced both in the Senate by Lautenberg and in the House by Waxman from California and Bobby Rush from Illinois to really coordinate and enforce a level of safety testing of chemicals, which doesn't exist in the United States currently. No one knows what the substitute is for BPA. That doesn't mean we shouldn't seek one. She's right that there are many studies which show BPA to be safe. There are other studies, though, in certain strains of rodents that show that BPA is not safe. There's a lot of work that's actually been done locally at Tufts Medical School, which indicates changes in both prostate and breast that could lead later to cancer. So I don't think we have the answer here. And we are wrestling with something that in science is a reality, and that is different laboratories using different strains of rats and different animal models will come up with different findings. And then in the few human studies that have been done, as I mentioned, there's a finding in Japan, but that hasn't been replicated, say, in the United States. So there's really a gray area here.
Mm-hmm. And it's consumers and everyday people who actually are falling into that gray area in terms of what they're putting in their bodies. Let's take a couple calls on that note. Namash is calling from Back Bay. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello. I just wanted to say that we knew less about DDT when we banned it than we do now about BPA. And I don't think there's any reason why we should wait any longer for more proof. We have tons of studies, and we have states like Connecticut and others that have already passed bills to ban BPA. I don't know why here in Massachusetts we have to wait any longer.
Well, Namasha, we might not be waiting much longer because there is some a regulation that's being proposed on banning BPA from baby bottles and children's sippy cups that may come sometime this summer. But thank you so much for your call. Let's get another one in here. Connor's calling from Lowell. Welcome to Radio Boston, Connor.
Hey, thank you very much. This is a great show. I wanted to contribute something. I've been hearing, you know, that this chemical might cause cancer and problems in prenatal, you know, in the infants or whatever. I'm coming from a generation that's diagnosed a lot with ADHD, ADD, a lot of these things having to do with the dopamine system of the brain, and they say that BPA might contribute to messing with the dopamine system. So I just wanted to, you know, hear about that. I think that myself, I've been exposed to it since I was in the womb, considering that the studies have shown my mother has it in her system, too.
Mm-hmm. Connor, thanks for your call. Dr. Grubman, is there any way to conclusively determine that these things are linked?
Well, I think the point that Connor just made from Lowell is a very interesting one, because the research on more than 2,000 mothers pregnant with children who were then followed for 10 years at Columbia, the most strong associations are between cognitive learning problems, hyperactivity, IQ issues, and so on, and exposure to certain chemicals, both phthalates and plastics and certain pesticides. So that Again, this is not absolute proof, mm-hmm. but it's sufficient concern. And, you know, you have to be very careful because there clearly is an increase in autism and no one knows why and everyone is desperate to find an answer. But these chemicals, again, in animal studies and now in some initial human cohorts, can be associated with brain changes during development, which lead to hyperactivity and learning problems.
Dr. Groopman, if I may, I mean, as you've stated, and many people know, the science is always evolving, and especially when it comes to epidemiology, as some of these studies are. There's the challenge of, like, who's your control group? You can't dose some people with BPA and not dose others. Mm-hmm. And so there's going to be constant tension on that. But you also mentioned something else in your article in The New Yorker, and that's on the regulation side. That really the last time we had comprehensive national regulation on toxics was back in 1976. And that law established the burden of proof about the toxicity or the health effects of chemicals, not on companies developing them or manufacturers using them, but on scientists and the government later on.
Absolutely. It's completely incorrect with regard to the current legislation and even the chemical industry. And I interviewed their main trade organization for the piece, agrees that the legislation is outdated. The bills that have been introduced in Congress would shift the responsibility onto the manufacturer and have a burden of proof with regard to safety. Now, the real question that's going to be debated is what we're talking about here. What are the criteria? How much safety? And how do you lead to public policy on that basis? And none of that is really defined yet in the legislation. It will be up to the EPA and other regulatory agencies. I also think that there's a way of looking at sort of a gradient, so to speak, or a distribution of risk. You know, if we have a high level of concern, even though we don't have absolute proof, around pregnant women and young children, then the precautionary principle of banning in sippy cups and so on, which Massachusetts is considering, would seem to make sense. While you wouldn't have an absolute ban on every potential use of BPA.
Well, that's Dr. Jerome Groopman. He is a professor at Harvard Medical School, staff writer for The New Yorker. His latest article in the current issue of The New Yorker is The Plastic Panic. He's also author of a number of books, including How Doctors Think. Dr. Jerome Groopman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure to be with you.
Up next, how do you measure or even feel about awesomeness? Well, how do you feel about ideas like biological red ink?
What I've put in there is bacteria growing on the paper, and you can see it's bright red.
Bright red and really awesome. Our guests have that down to a science. More after a break. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.